Appreciate the welcoming home remarks several of you have given us. You've asked if we have adjusted to the jet lag and time change, and the answer is mostly. Mostly. It's 5 hours difference from here to England, and we spent the last 3 days in Belgium where it's 6 hours difference. So in some ways, we're still making incremental adjustments. I think the first night we got back home, we were so exhausted. We love the game show Jeopardy, because just quiz aspect. We fell asleep in the second half of what we had recorded, so we had no idea how that one turned out. But I just heard somebody calling my name, and it was quiet, and all was, Doug, honey, we slept through the last half. We should go to bed. It was 8:30. So, of course, to us, if we're still sort of on Belgium time, that felt like 2:30 in the morning, so after a very, very long day in traveling home. But it was a remarkable trip. We had three separate trips in a way. The feast, which was tremendous. We were in Eastbourne on the Channel, English Channel. We had our room faced the ocean. We opened the window at night so we could hear the ocean sound. And the first night of the feast, just a gorgeous moon rising out of the ocean, silvery shadows in the water, and every morning sunrise up over the water. So it was a lovely setting. We had some fantastic tours in various areas we saw. One thing happened after we got back. When I was young, especially, I loved reading the Conan Doyle stories, Sherlock Holmes mysteries. I read them all many times. And then we found out after the feast. My wife checked the Facebook of John and Jane Dean, the folks we met there. They're Americans, but they love to travel around. And they had gone after the feast just 5 miles from Eastbourne, where we were. She took a picture. There was a house there that had a little plaque on it. And the plaque said, Sherlock Holmes, the consulting detective, retired here from 1906 to 1917 and kept bees at the end of his career. And I looked at that and said, 5 miles away? And I didn't know it? So we're going back next week. It's going to be a little expensive, but especially just to see that one little... No, we're not. Next time, somehow. We had some wonderful experiences. We had a fine feast. The messages all dovetailed beautifully into a theme of comfort and caring for those God will work with following the return of Christ into the millennium and the great white throne judgment period. Mr. Hawkins and I were the only pastors on site until late in the feast. Mr. and Mrs. Meeker joined us. Both Mr. Meeker and I had the same experiences. Our luggage didn't accompany us all the way to the hotel, so... In the case of him, the airlines misplaced it, and it was back within about a day and a half. And in the case of mine, the airlines got it there fine, but another passenger didn't bother to check the tabs and walked off with it instead of her own piece. So thankfully, since hers was the only one left and it was a similar type of garment, we had it figured out, and the airlines had it back in their hands within 6 hours and back to me the next day. So I will pack more carefully what I put in the little roller bag that I carry with me, though. It'll be more important to have certain items in there, just in case, so I will know better than that. My suits didn't fit her, so she did return them, so I appreciated that. One of the tours we had was had an especially unusual ending to it. On day 7 of the feast, as it happened, the English Historical Society had planned for some time, because the actual date was October the 14th. That was the Friday, but they planned on the Saturday the 15th and again on Sunday the 16th to have a reenactment of the Battle of Hastings from 1066. It actually happened on the 14th of October, 1066. So that was one of our tours. Mr. Hawkins set it up, and several of us boarded the charter coach, as they call them, a bus, and went to Hastings, only about an hour drive from Eastbourne. And on the field at Hastings, they had over 300 reenactors with horses and the whole shooting match, as they say, pardon the pun, with the arrows. But, of course, the numbers were much larger in the actual battle, but they had a commentary and explained in the movement of the troops and the horses and so on what was happening. And, of course, when it's all over, the Saxons, King Harold died, and the Saxons were defeated, and William the Conqueror and the Normans took over in the only and the most recent successful invasion of England, 1066. But then came, they hear all these, you know, the actors are lying down as if they've been killed on the field. And then the commentator made the words, he said the words, he said, in 1066, of course, this was a field of battle, and there was usual battlefield carnage, and the dead lie on the field for days until it was taken care of. But he said, we're going to ask all of you with us today to participate in a small miracle. So when I, on the count of three, we want everyone here to say, let the dead arise. So on the, and there were probably 1,000 or more people there, maybe two, and not from the feast. We only had 110 at the feast, but so I said on the count of three, and then all this thunderous throng, the voices all say, let the dead arise. And there's movement out on the field, and the shields are cast aside, and the men in armor stand up, and the hair rose on the back of my neck, and I'm sure on the back of all of our necks, to think from those of us in the church. It was on the eve of the last great day. It was the afternoon, but the next day was to be the eighth day, or the last great day, when the dead will arise in the second resurrection. And that was quite something. So we found that a moving experience. I hope that you had the opportunity to view this week's edition of In Accord from Mr. Franks. It was the first one after the Feast of 2022. He recorded it earlier in the week. In fact, the entire administration has already gone by now. They left, I believe, on either Wednesday or Thursday. Okay, maybe Friday. Yesterday, to fly to Mexico for the next round of the International Leadership Program. In the Latin American area, the northern Latin American area, they've already been to Chile for the southern part. But he talked about some of the feast stories, and they interviewed three of the staff members from the office, two of whom had gone to international sites, one to France, one to Mexico, and about their experiences at the feast, and he wanted to talk about the theme of the feast. And it's the lesson that he mentioned that I want to focus on today, to follow up, if I might. In that way, it connects, in a sense, with a theme we frequently see play out for us on this, the second Sabbath after the Feast of Tabernacles. And the lesson is the lesson of humility. What did we read in these verses today in the blessing of children's service about if you don't receive the kingdom of God like a little child, you won't be there? The concept of the simplicity and the humility of a child. And in one way, it certainly ties into a similar connected or related theme to Mr. Rushton's sermonette today about self-control. Mr. Franks talked about the importance of being humbled by the experience of keeping the feast. And we sometimes note the moments of pleasure and touching moments and sometimes amusing moments with the blessing of children's service. Sometimes we have them go quietly into the night, as we saw today. Other times the poor children don't know what's going on, and they are letting their displeasure and discomfort be known for the whole audience, embarrassing the parents no end, but making all of us realize that's just the way things are sometimes. I think we can understand why this ceremony has such deep meaning. God is our Father. And we, in His presence, need to be like little children. Like humble little children, learning to follow His guidance in our lives. It's practical. It's daily. It's humbling and it's concerning. And like every aspect of God's calling and purpose, it's a blessing. Just like the ceremony says. Probably one of the greatest blessings of all comes from being raised in a godly home. We wish in some ways that we could see all children in this world have some sorts of blessing that they need. But we have this special ceremony in God's church because we recognize that here is where those children have the opportunity to be raised by a godly parent, or hopefully both parents. And that makes it extra special. That makes it have, well, it has meaning when their parents are involved in teaching them God's way. God is not working at this point with most in the world. We know that there's a little flock, Luke 12:32. He is not at this time calling and working with the vast majority of mankind. He intends to work with everyone. He intends, as we experienced at the feast in the meaning of the eighth day, the last great day, He intends to give everyone the opportunity. It's what so moved us on the field at Hastings in that reenactment back on the 16th of October on the Sunday, day 7 of the feast. When those words were spoken, let the dead arise, and you saw it graphically in front of you, and a tiny, tiny little depiction of what it might be like in the future. That's the time when most will understand, most of humanity that's ever existed. In a home now, though, where God's law is upheld as being the standard for living that operates in a cause and effect manner that sets a person from his or her earliest days on a path designed by God to connect to a pattern of blessing and gifts from Him. That's special. It's also humbling. In a sense, you know, this ceremony is not a kind of mystical, magical, spiritual wand that the ministers wave over the babies with no logical connection to the real world. God's way is not like that. God's way makes sense. What is it like? Well, it's a way of cause and effect. It's a way of choices and consequences. And there are lessons we can learn from today's ceremony for us, the big people. I'm sure if you were to ask Tyler in about 12 years if what he remembers from the day he was blessed, he'll say, nothing. Nothing. We probably have a number of people in the audience today, young people among us and, you know, families and so on, who've been blessed. Ask them what they remember. And the answer, nothing. Because they were the ones as babies that were receiving the ceremony. There are always lessons we can learn. Interestingly, one of the first scriptures that's referenced in our little ministerial black book, we call it the little black book of ceremonies in the church, about this one, about the blessing of children, one of the first verses cited is from the book of Numbers, chapter 6. Numbers chapter 6. And beginning in verse 22. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron and his sons, saying, this is the way you shall bless the children of Israel. Say to them, the Lord bless you and keep you. Aaron wasn't saying the blessing from himself or Moses. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. So they shall invoke, my Bible has in the margin, they shall invoke my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them. It's a very special place and a reference. Did you notice anything that struck you? The very first thing that hit me was the reference, this is the way you shall bless. Why does God say that? What does he always want to do? He wants to give a blessing for his people. There are things that are allowed that sometimes we have trouble understanding. Sometimes we have questions for which there are no answers today. But in time, we hope and pray that God will help us understand. And that's what we have to rely on in difficult times. But these words show his intent and where he's headed and what his desire is. Our lives, of course, as we know from the scripture, are transitory. They're but a vapor, some passages say. They're here and gone. They go quickly. The older we get, the more we realize that. They go by quickly. Right after that, the next words he says, the children of Israel. You shall bless the children of Israel. We are God's children. This ceremony today reminds us we're his children. We're his little kids. And we need to tune into what his guidance is. It's a very common way that he refers to them in the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible. He refers to them that way from the time he intervenes in their captivity in Egypt right up to the entry into the promised land. It's an obvious connection to today's ceremony. Then it says, make his face shine upon you and lift up his countenance upon you. Those are connected descriptions. They mean the same thing. You know, it's like a doting parent with face beaming in joy at his children. I don't know if you could see the faces of the parents up here today, Matt and Erica Pavlik, but, you know, they were smiling, and Tyler was deciding what he was going to do. It's a special ceremony, and you see parents who do care for and love their children, and that tells us what God has for us, how he views us. He wants the same thing for us that we want for our children, good things, good things. And of course, that depends on us as his children too. We have choices to make, and so do our children as they grow. And then he says in verse 27, after saying, "Be gracious to you and give you peace," more of what his intent is, "so they shall invoke or put my name on the children of Israel, and I will bless them." There's something of cause and effect here. Does one lead to the other? I believe it does. Deuteronomy 28 is a famous chapter of blessings and cursings, but I only want to read the blessings part today, because here is where some questions are very clearly answered. What is God's intent? Look at what he wanted to do for the nation of Israel back then. Now, we're not a nation today, not a body that is a nation. We're a spiritual body, the church. Verse 1, it says in Deuteronomy 28, "It shall come to pass, if you diligently obey the voice of the Lord your God, to observe carefully all his commandments which I command you today, that the Lord your God will set you high above all nations of the earth. And all these blessings shall come upon you and overtake you." That's quite a visual when you stop and think about it. It's like you're running down the road as fast as you can trying to get away from blessings, and they still catch up to you. Think, well, that's pretty good. "Because you obey the voice of the Lord your God, blessed shall you be in the city, and blessed shall you be in the country. Blessed shall be the fruit of your body, the produce of your ground, and the increase of your herds, the increase of your cattle, and the offspring of your flocks. Blessed shall be your basket and your kneading bowl. Blessed shall you be when you come in, and blessed shall you be when you go out. The Lord will cause your enemies who rise against you to be defeated before your face. They'll come out against you one way and flee before you seven. He'll command a blessing on your storehouses, in which all to which you set your hand, he will bless you in the land which he's giving you. He'll establish you as a holy people to himself." I gave a sermon on that not too long ago before the feast here, and I reprised it actually for one of the messages I had in England during the feast, the one in the middle. "The Lord will establish you as a holy people, just as he had sworn to you, if," look at the conditional, "if you keep the commandments of the Lord your God and walk in his ways." That's what it requires to be considered by God a holy people, to be obedient. "Then all the peoples of the earth will see that you're called by his name, and they'll be afraid of you. And the Lord will grant you plenty of goods in the fruit of your body, the increase of your livestock, the produce of your ground, in the land which he swore to your fathers to give you. He'll open his good treasure, the heavens, to give rain in its season and bless the work of your hand. You'll be a lender to many nations, but you shall not borrow." You know, we need to take a look sometimes at what goes on around us in our world and ask questions. Why is it that God's not blessing this country in the way that he once does? Well, does it have anything to do with the conduct of the peoples? Even just in a financial way, I was looking the last day or two at the news from the financial markets about home mortgages. That's one measure that they use to see where rates are going. You know, 2 years ago, if you had decided you wanted to, let's say, take out a mortgage to buy a house, if you could have taken out a 15-year note, you could have gotten a 15-year mortgage for less than 2.5% 2 years ago. A little bit more for a 30-year note. The latest news is that 30-year mortgages are up over 7% average in the last week for the first time in 20 years. And 15-year notes are at about 6.25% to 6.5%, also quite a bit higher. Up from, 2.25%, 2.5% to 6.25%, 6.5% in 2 years. So something's not right in so many ways. And it shows up in many ways. Here it is. It talks about lending and borrowing. Well, that's a very direct application. "The Lord will make you the head, not the tail. You'll be above only, not be beneath, if you heed the commandments of the Lord, which I command you today, and are careful to observe them. You shall not turn aside from any of the words which I command you this day, to the right or the left, to go after other gods to serve them." Our nations have long since departed from a path even resembling that. This is where God wants to go. Now, the rest of this chapter talks about the curses for disobedience. I'm not going to focus on that. You can see that it's much larger in its extent than the section on the blessings, and that's sad. That's sad. This was the way God worked with a nation of people in the Old Testament. It was less frequently directed toward individuals because God was not yet working in that sense so much with individuals. A handful, not a lot. How could they learn some of those lessons? Well, as a nation, here's what he told them in chapter 8 of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 8, verse 1, "Every commandment which I command you today, you must be careful to observe, that you may live and multiply and go in and possess the land of which the Lord swore to your fathers. And you'll remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you," there's our theme for today, "to humble you and test you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not." It is not our business to decide what the commandments are. Our choice is, will we keep them or not? It is not our business to decide, well, you know, I don't think it means that. We don't define what it means. God's word defines what it means. Our decision is, will I be in compliance or not? And more than that, will I love being obedient to God? That's our choice. So it says, he humbled you. He allowed you to hunger, and he fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, so that he might make you know this lesson: man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Your garments didn't wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years. You should know in your heart that as a man chastens his son, so God chastens you. Therefore, you'll keep his commandments, walk in his ways to fear him. He is bringing you into a good land, a land of brooks of water, of fountains and springs and valleys and hills, wheat, barley, vines, fig trees, pomegranates, olive oil, honey. Makes you get hungry for snacks after church already. A land in which you'll eat bread without scarcity, in which you will lack nothing. A land whose stones are iron and out of whose hills you can dig copper. When you've eaten and you're full, then you'll bless the Lord your God for the good land which he's given you. There are two reactions that happen when people are blessed and have been fortunate and good things have come their way. They either humbly acknowledge God as the source, or they egotistically think it's all because of their abilities. Which is it for us? Beware that you don't forget God by not keeping his commandments, judgments, and statutes. When you've eaten, less than, when you're full, and you've built beautiful houses and dwell in them, when your herds and your flocks multiply, your silver and gold are multiplied or increased, all that you have, when your heart is lifted up and you forget the Lord your God who brought you out of Egypt and the house of bondage, who led you through the great and terrible wilderness, which had fiery serpents and scorpions and a thirsty land with no water, who brought water for you out of the flinty rock and fed you in the wilderness with manna, that he might humble you and he might test you to do you good in the end. Don't say in your heart, my power and the might of my hand have gained me this wealth. People might think, well, you know, my abilities, I have such a great abilities, I have a strong back, or I have a good mind, or I've got these talents. Let me ask one question. Who gave those to you? Who gave those to you? If you have a strong back, where did it come from? If you have a good mind, who designed that? If you have skills and abilities, are those to your credit or were they given to you? Those are the things we have to ask, according to Deuteronomy 8. You will remember the Lord your God, for it is he who gives you power to get wealth. He supplies those blessings, that he may establish his covenant, which he swore to your fathers as it is this day. And he says in the next two verses, if you don't go this way, if you choose to follow other gods, we might say, well, not leering idols today, but the gods of materialism or vanity or influence or power or prestige or whatever it is, he says, I testify, you shall surely perish. And just like I've destroyed the nations before you, if you choose that path, you'll be destroyed too, he says, in paraphrase. The entire chapter is a lesson in humility, a lesson that we're God's children. And we have to acknowledge him as the God who guides us, blesses us, leads us, and directs our steps. And as Mr. Franks asked the question, were we humbled by our experience of keeping the feast to realize those things are true? You know, there's an interesting example in the life of one individual. In 2 Chronicles chapter 7, a famous king. The chapter begins in chapter 7 with God dramatically answering Solomon's prayer at the dedication of the temple. A king who started out beautifully. But as you come down to verse 12, we see that part. The Lord appeared to Solomon by night and said to him, I've heard your prayer, and I've chosen this place for myself as a house of sacrifice, this temple that Solomon built. When I shut up heaven and there's no rain, or command the locusts to devour the land, or send pestilence among my people, if my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face, and maybe you can hear the music running through your head as I can when I read those words, and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven, and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. My eyes will be open and my ears attentive to prayer made in this place. But interestingly enough, the Israelites at the time, both houses still together here, misunderstood God's meaning. They began to think that it was the temple that was important. We just read what was important in verse 14. If my people, who are called by my name, will humble themselves and pray and seek my face. That's what's important. Later in their history, they got to thinking that the temple was all that was important, and they could do whatever they wanted as long as the temple was there. Bad choice. The temple in that case was just a pile of rocks and metals and cloth and who knows what else, but it was nothing without yieldedness to God. For I have chosen and sanctified this house. I've set it apart that my name may be there forever. But he already gave the qualifier back in verse 14. If my people. That's how long the forever lasts. My heart will be there perpetually. As for you, if you walk before me as your father David did and do what I've commanded you and you keep my statutes and judgments, I'll establish the throne of your kingdom just as I did his. Well, we know that Solomon later made some very poor choices after a wonderful beginning. What about our influence and example? Solomon's influenced a whole nation for years, the golden age of Solomon. What about our example? Do we impact the lives of others? Brethren, we do. We do have an impact on them. The concept of humility is given here just as it is everywhere God talks to his people about how to obey him. And that was a factor in how God dealt with the people as a whole back then. It's a factor in our lives now. And it happened even later on, too. Later, look at their example, Ezra chapter 8, for example. In Ezra chapter 8, after both nations had gone into captivity, we're talking about the period of time of the restoration, the return from captivity of the southern captives from Judah. Famous section where Ezra has instructions from the king to begin work in Jerusalem to rebuild the city and the temple. But they have to get there safely, and so he's a little worried. Verse 21 of Ezra 8, he said, I proclaimed a fast there at the river of Ahava that we might humble ourselves. There's the theme again. Before our God to seek from him the right way for us and our little ones and all our possessions. For I was ashamed to request from the king an escort of soldiers and horsemen to help us against the enemy on the road, because we'd already spoken to the king and said, God's hand is on us for good for all those who are seeking him. But his power and his wrath are against those who forsake him. So we fasted and entreated our God for this, and he answered our prayer. Those are important things and lessons to learn as we go to God and ask in prayer. And if the answer is one we don't understand, we ask that he'll give us patience and understanding in the time that he gives. Famous section. That attention to obedience to God is shown a bit later in their history, right down at the very end of the Old Testament period, in the book of Malachi in chapter 3. In the intertestamental period, you might have noted in Accord this week, Dr. Levy had a moment where he was explaining the next set of classes starting this week on this coming Wednesday night for FI Online on the post-exilic prophets of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi. This is maybe 400 years before the time of Christ that these words were written. And in Malachi chapter 3, in verse 10, God says, "Bring all the tithe into the storehouse, so there can be food in my house. And try me in this, says the Lord of hosts, if I will not open for you the windows of heaven and pour out for you such blessing that there won't be room enough to receive it. I'll rebuke the devourer for your sakes. It won't destroy the fruit of your ground, nor shall the vine fail to bear fruit for you in the field. All nations will call you blessed. You'll be a delightful land, says the Lord of hosts." That's from obedience. The previous two verses talk about what happens from disobedience. This leads to God's blessing. He knows what way of life leads to the right results. And, of course, this illustrates how we set an example for others around us, too, just as they did back then. It has millennial overtones. I won't turn to Zechariah 8. I'm sure Dr. Levy will cover that in these upcoming FI online classes starting just this week on the 2nd of November. But let's get back to that humility aspect for another look and a general observation of our sort of trip to the Old Testament and the theme, humbled by keeping the feast. Isaiah 57. Just a verse that seems in the middle of other topics. In Isaiah 57:15, it says, "Thus says the High and Lofty One, the one who inhabits eternity." Can you understand that? What's it like to inhabit eternity? To live in timelessness. We live in time. Our lives are governed by time. You look in the mirror in the morning, and you might not notice any difference from yesterday morning, but if you had a picture from, let's say, a couple of decades ago, you just might notice a difference. We're governed by time. God says, "I live in timelessness. I live in eternity." What's that like? "Whose name is holy. I dwell in the high and holy place with him who has a contrite and humble spirit." And here's what I do. I revive the spirit of the humble, and I revive the heart of the contrite ones. "And I won't contend forever, nor will I always be angry. For the spirit would fail before me in the souls which I've made." God says, "This is what I want. This is what impresses me," as we know from chapter 66 and verse 2. How many times have we read that verse? 66:2, "All these things have my hand has made, the heaven, the earth," he said in verse 1. "But on this one will I look," Isaiah 66:2, "on him who is poor and of a contrite spirit and who trembles at my word." Humility is the password. Humility is the password. Username, "I am called by your name." Password, humility. All lowercase, otherwise it's drawing too much attention to itself if you capitalized it all. There's another millennial connection in Isaiah 2 we're familiar with. Isaiah chapter 2. "It shall come to pass," verse 2, this is the vision Isaiah saw about Judah and Jerusalem, "in the latter days, that the mountain of the Eternal's house shall be established on the top of the mountains, be exalted above the hills, all nations shall flow to it. Many people shall come and say, 'Let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, the house of the God of Jacob. He will teach us his ways, we'll walk in his paths. For out of Zion shall go forth the law and the word of the Lord from Jerusalem, and he'll judge between the nations and rebuke people. They'll beat their swords into plowshares, spears into pruning hooks." This is the future. This is the future. You drop down to verse 10. Notice the theme. "Enter into the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and the glory of his majesty. The proud looks of man shall be humbled. The haughtiness of men shall be bowed down, and the Lord alone shall be exalted in that day." Verse 11. That's the theme. That's the future. That's a key lesson. God alone is exalted. But you know what he wants to do for us? There are other verses that talk about humble yourselves that I may do what? That I may exalt you in due time. The password. There were certainly some individuals in the Old Testament who grasped the concept. I have to think David understood when he said in the 8th Psalm, you know, he said, when I consider the heavens that your hand has made, and I look at all these things in the 8th Psalm, and he says, what is man that you're mindful of him? What is this insignificant little pipsqueak worm on the earth that you pay any attention at all? That's Johnson's translation. The moon and the stars you've ordained. What is man that you're mindful of him? The Son of Man, you visit him. You've made him a little while lower than the angels. You have crowned him with glory and honor. What is his intent? You made him to have dominion over the works of your hands. God's intent and plan and future is amazing. Study the Psalms anew with that focus to look for evidence of David's humility and the others who wrote the Psalms, whether it be the sons of Korah or Moses had a psalm or two in there, and others that are untitled or unattributed. Asaph, of course, had a number as well, the director of music in the temple. So many, the humility. Asaph wrote, he said, you know, when I looked at the wicked and how they prosper, and he says, and my foot nearly stumbled until I considered their end. And then I chose to go to your house, Psalm 73. Think about some of those things. Well, that takes us really up to some New Testament territory. Let's pick up a couple more themes from there before we stop today. We probably know the incident that led to the establishment of our church tradition, the blessing of children, which we had today. Take a look at Matthew's account of it. The context of the attitude of the disciples. Matthew's account of the blessing of children is actually in chapter 19, verses 13 to 15. But look at the context of what was happening just before that, the previous chapter, chapter 18 of Matthew, verse 1. At that time, the disciples came to Jesus saying, who then is greatest in the kingdom of heaven? They just weren't getting this humility thing yet, were they? Next chapter, he had to say, look, let me bring this little child here and show you what I'm talking about. Then Jesus, he even has a little bit of a reference here. Jesus called a little child to him and set him in the midst of them and said, I say to you, unless you're converted and become as little children, you will by no means enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever humbles himself as this little child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever receives one little child like this in my name receives me. The very next chapter, he had to do the whole thing all over again with the reference in Matthew to the blessing ceremony that we do every year. You talk to them pretty straight. In the first few verses of chapter 18, humility is required. Without that overall approach, we won't even be in the kingdom of God, a spirit being in his family. The word for humble that's used here is a Greek word that's hard to pronounce. It's tapanoo. I won't even try to spell it. But it means to make low or to abase or to humble oneself. And there are lots of places where it's used in the New Testament, and sometimes they can help us. Peter wrote about it, and he used it in 1 Peter chapter 5 in his message, in his first letter, 1 Peter 5 and verse 6. Verse 5 says, likewise, you younger people, 1 Peter 5, 5, submit yourselves to your elders. All of you be submissive to one another and be clothed with humility. For God resists the proud, but he gives grace to the humble. Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God that he may exalt you in due time. Look at that. Look at what he intends to do. Casting all your care on him, he cares for you. Humble yourself that he may exalt you. It's the pathway. Those who want to exalt themselves are getting ahead of the scheme. And it will never work in the long run. We see plenty of that in the world around us. We don't want to be that way. We want to follow the path that he says we should follow. humble ourselves under his hand and let him exalt us. It's the same throughout the scriptures. Jesus said in his parables, when you go to a feast, don't sit in the chief seat. Go and sit down, you know, at the low end, and then let the person who invites you say, friend, you are supposed to be here. Come up here. It's a lot more embarrassing if they say, would you please get out of there because you're sitting in the really important person's seat, you know. There's an approach that needs to be followed. Do you and I do that? Same Greek word. God alone is exalted. James 4, James uses the same word. James chapter 4, verse 10, he says, humble yourselves in the sight of the Lord, and look at the last half of the verse. Here we are again. And he will lift you up. He has a plan, but we don't want to get ahead of it. You know, in microcosm, Moses did that, didn't he? There are some examples. Moses did that. He went out when he was still the prince of Egypt, and he went out to survey what was happening to the enslaved Israelites, and he saw a taskmaster beating one of the Israelites. So the next day, he came back, and it happened again, and he killed the Egyptian. It says in the New Testament that Moses thought that his brethren understood that God would deliver them by his hand. He was ahead of the game. He had the idea of what God wanted him to do, but he was taking the wrong approach. He was going to grab hold of it and take hold of it there. He was 40. He was at the height of his powers. He was a famous Egyptian general, according to Josephus and other sources, defeating the Ethiopians in a battle that was crucial for the survival of Egypt. But God said, wait until you're 80 and you've herded sheep for 40 years. Then you'll be ready. Then you'll be ready. God has a very different way of doing things. And I might add, he also has a pretty good sense of humor. Because we humans are funny creatures. There are more explanations. Acts chapter 20, Paul said something Luke recorded. Acts chapter 20. This is the case where Paul is sailing to get back to Jerusalem, probably for Pentecost. And as he gets to the port city of Miletus, he calls to the elders of Ephesus from in Asia Minor, the seven churches in modern-day Turkey, the mail route. And he calls for them in verse 17 of Acts 20. And he talks to them a little bit about what's going on. He says, when they had come, he said, you know, from the first day that I came to Asia, in what manner I always lived among you. This would be what we call Asia Minor, like I said. Serving the Lord with all humility, with many tears and trials which happened to me by the plotting of the Jews, I kept back nothing that was helpful, but I proclaimed it to you and taught you publicly and from house to house. And he talks about the importance of finishing his race. And he says, I'm innocent of the blood of all men, verse 26. I've not avoided to declare to you God's whole counsel. And he urges them, he says in verse 28, take heed to yourselves among the flock, those that God has made you overseers to shepherd the church of God that he purchased with his own blood. And look at the contrasting problem. I know that after my departure, savage wolves will come in, not sparing the flock. That is the opposite of humility. And he pleads with them. He pleads with them. It's interesting when he says, I serve the Lord with all humility. He's using the same root word that we've been talking about. It's a different variation, but it's the same root. What does it all mean? It means literally lowliness of mind. It means Paul practiced what he preached when he had told the Roman church in chapter 12 of Romans. He says, I say to you, through the grace given to me, Romans 12:3, I'll just read it to you, to everyone among you, not to think of yourself more highly than you ought to think. Think soberly, humbly, as God has dealt to each a measure of faith. We need the qualities that are given that way, and Paul continued to talk about it in his letters. He mentions it in Colossians chapter 3. Colossians chapter 3, verse 12, he says, as the elect of God, holy and beloved, put on tender mercies, kindness, humility, meekness, long-suffering. There's something interesting going on here in Colossians 3. Look at what he says in verse 12, and what's the analogy? The analogy is putting on clothing. I wanted very much to do that. The first Sabbath we were in England for the feast, Mr. Hawkins sort of threw me a curve, and I was already scheduled for three sermons during the feast. He said, would you speak on the Sabbath? I don't have any. Oh, okay. He said, just teach your first class. Teach class one of, okay. I had no suits. I had the sport coat I had worn on the plane. I had my tennis shoes, and so I stood up. And the first time I ever gave a sermon in tennis shoes, that's that I can think of. So I do teach in them sometimes. They're comfortable. My wife and I call them my eclectic professor shoes. So that's all I had was my Lee's jeans and a sport coat and a borrowed tie and a shirt that would pass sort of for being dressed. Thankfully, the clothes made their appearance later that evening. But putting on clothing. I had limited choices that day. Thankfully, I had better choices later. These are qualities of character. Put on tender mercies. That's a jacket you need to wear. Put on kindness. That's a piece of clothing you need to wear. Put on humility. You need to wear that. Put on meekness. Put on long-suffering. When you put on these qualities, when you develop and invest in these qualities of character, how does it show itself? How does it look? Well, here's what it looks like in the lives of others and the perceptions of others. This is what you'll end up doing. You'll be bearing with one another. And you'll be forgiving one another. If anyone has a complaint against another, as Christ forgave you, you must do the same thing. And then above all these things, put on love, which is the bond of perfection. We're talking about qualities of character to develop that you wear like clothing, so you react in a certain way and you treat people in a certain way. Can you and I do that? Can you and I see that's what's needed? He wrote to the Ephesians with similar thoughts. I won't spend a whole lot of time, but Ephesians 4, verses 1 and 2, he says, I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling that you were called, with all lowliness, same word in Greek, tapanoo, with all lowliness or humility and gentleness, long-suffering, bearing with one another. What does it lead to? The next few verses talk about how we're one in God, the unity. There's cause and effect. How are we doing in this only acceptable mindset for a truly converted, yielded, humbled child of God? That's who we are. In Philippians 2, we've read before how we're to be of a certain mind. In verse 5, it says, let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus. Where did that come from? Verses 2 and 3. He uses the Greek word for humility. It's translated lowliness in verse 3. Let nothing be done through selfish ambition or conceit, but in lowliness of mind or humility, let each esteem others better than himself. That's what Jesus Christ did. And it says that in verse 8, he, being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself, same Greek word, and became obedient to the point of death. Therefore, God has highly exalted him. And what have we just been reading? God is saying, humble yourselves before God so that he may exalt you in due time. That's his purpose. That's his plan. But we have to start and get it in the right order. Which way are we going? Which way are we going? I said earlier that Paul practiced what he preached. Take a look at Romans chapter 12. I don't know that I'll read through all of this today here. I did this morning in Youngstown. We had a little shorter service. We just went straight to announcements today without a sermonette there. But look in chapter 12 of Romans. Look at this long, long sort of laundry list of characteristics and of actions. Beginning in verse 9, he just says, let love be without hypocrisy. Go through right to the end of the chapter in your own personal studies sometime and take a look at each expression. Let love be without hypocrisy. Think about that. Meditate about it. Maybe pray about it. Abhor what is evil. What does that mean? Cling to what is good. How does that look? Be kindly affectionate to one another with brotherly love. How does that translate itself in our lives. In honor, giving preference to one another. Not lagging in diligence, fervent in spirit, serving the Lord, rejoicing in hope, patient in tribulation. Read the list all the way down through the end of the chapter. It's amazing. An astonishing list. And the core of it at the end, he says in verse 17, repay no one evil for evil. If it is possible, verse 18, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Beloved, don't avenge yourselves. Give place to wrath. Put wrath over there in its place. Vengeance is mine, says God. I will repay. That's not the way our world does it. Our world says, make my day. I don't get even. Well, no, I don't come back at you. I get even. I'll do you one better. That's our world. It's not God's world. God, he says, if your enemy's hungry, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him a drink. Don't be overcome by evil. Overcome evil with good. What's our life like? A godly mindset? Different from this world? I hope so. Of course, that's the plan God has, is to bring many children to glory. Are we ready for that? Only if we have humbly come before our God. And the little ceremony we had earlier, we'll pick on Tyler Matthew Pavlik today, illustrating to us what it's supposed to look like. He won't remember this in 10 years, so I don't have to apologize to him right now for embarrassing him. Someday. What a simple way to view things. Be like a little child. How easy to say, how tough to live. Uncomplicated. What you see is what you get. Is that a lesson we brought home with us from God's feast? Mr. Franks asked us if we had been humbled by keeping the feast this year. Humbled by blessings. Humbled by mysteries and challenges, sometimes by tragedies. Humbled by God's hand in what he's doing. I'll finish up with a couple of quotes, two by individuals who knew nothing of God's purpose and plan in their lifetimes, as demonstrated by the way they lived. Still remarkable people. Here's a quote that says, a man wrapped up in himself makes a very small bundle. Benjamin Franklin. And then one, humility like darkness reveals the heavenly lights. Humility like darkness reveals the heavenly lights. Henry David Thoreau. Someday they'll understand. How about one more quote? This one in Proverbs 15:33 from a man who started out beautifully and stumbled. The fear of the Lord is the instruction of wisdom, and before honor is humility. Before honor is humility.